This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about apples. Can science help us achieve a crisper, sweeter apple? How about a more tart apple? My guests are Susan Brown, professor of agriculture and head of the apple breeding program at Cornell University, Dan Bussey, orchardist with the Seed Savers Exchange, author of the forthcoming Apple Epic, Illustrated History of Apples in North America. And our phone number is 844-724-8255. Let me ask you, Susan, first, is there an apple out there that you still yet are looking for? You and I, what's your dream?
Always. Always. So we have, when you're asking, boulders. So we have boulder flavors. We have unique flavors. We have some that are very spicy and might be suited for both fresh eating and cider. But I would like to produce an apple that has high quality and is consistent but appeals to the younger generation, because they're still not eating enough apples. And so having something with much more of a sugar acid balance and perhaps bold flavors could be equivalent to a natural shuck tart type of apple.
Dan, do you have any one that you're looking for? Did you like to find?
Oh, lots. A couple in mind. One is actually kind of local to Wisconsin, a variety called Delavan. Its juice was noted to stick to your hands like molasses. And another variety is the Golden Wilding. It was one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite cider varieties. Mixed with the Hughes crab, it was absolutely superior in his mind. Mm-hmm. And I would love to find that one.
Let me see if I get one more call in. Let's go to Highlands, North Carolina. Ken, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I was going to put out five or six Red and Delicious trees and was wondering if your guests could recommend another variety that would help cross-pollinate.
Oh, so you're starting your own orchard is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. What's Susan, Dan, a hint for him? What he should be doing?
Anything else, any other variety besides the Red Delicious, or if that's what you were planning, would be a good one to pollinate. Crab apples typically are good pollinators.
Any variety except sports of Red Delicious, because they have to be genetically different.
Okay, Ken, does that work for you?
It does, and I guess their opinion on the Red and Delicious as well, or maybe should I mix it up even more?
Never hurts to. I think that's the joy of it, is the difference in the varieties that you'll find.
It's important that they bloom at the same time.
Mm. Yeah. Most of the time, they're very close to each other, but yeah, it's good to have some that are at the exact same time.
Yeah, it depends on the region. So in our region, they can be separate quite a bit.
I didn't realize that a crab apple is a real apple. I don't know why. I used to have them on my lawn all the time. But it is a real apple, a tiny little apple.
Right. And they contain sources of resistance that we use in breeding. So, for example, to the scab that a lot of apples get if it rains in the spring. And so those crab apples in our repository have been used to give resistance to a lot of different pathogens.
Hmm. Yeah. Some of the crabs with the high tannins are sort of have antifungal properties as well.
Antifungal properties?
Yep.
So they're more resistant to it then?
A little bit more so.
Mm-hmm. What can we do to help preserve some of these old apple varieties that we're talking so much about? Dan?
I think basically just be aware where you find them. Can you tell, is it an old tree? Has it been around a long time? Can you see that it's been grafted? If you see a graft union, which is sort of a change in the color or a bump in the bark below the first set of scaffold branches, at least you will have an idea that it was a cultivated grafted tree versus a wild seedling, which could just sprout from somebody pitching an apple out of their car as they're driving after eating it.
Susan, Dan, we've run out of time. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Susan Brown, Professor of Agriculture at Cornell University, where she also heads the Apple Breeding Program. And Dan Bussey is Orchard Manager at Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. He's also author of the forthcoming Illustrated History of Apples in North America. Next up, think of George Washington Carver, and you probably think, what? Yeah, peanuts. He did invent some 300 uses for the nut, from soaps to lotions. shaving cream, paper. He did not invent peanut butter. We'll get to that a little bit later. But beyond peanuts, Carver was a modern-day Renaissance man. He revolutionized farming in the American South. He was a painter, a singer, a piano teacher, and an educator. And last week, Tuskegee University gathered scientists together, including my next guests, to celebrate Carver and his scientific innovations. It was the 150th anniversary of his birth. Kathy Wilteke is a chief scientist and undersecretary for research, education, and economics at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Good afternoon.
You're welcome. Dan Chandler is the archivist at Tuskegee University. At Tuskegee University in Tuskegee, Alabama. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Good afternoon.
Kathy, so first things first, George Washington Carver did not invent peanut butter.
He certainly popularized it, though, along with over 300 uses of peanuts. He's certainly known for introducing the peanut and being a peanut evangelist to farmers in Alabama to really improve the soils by using peanuts in rotation with other crops, and also to provide a higher protein vegetable product for farmers' families, as well as to bring to market.
Yeah, and he invented a lot of other uses for the peanut besides eating it, didn't he?
Well, you named some of them, everything from linoleum to nitroglycerin to dyes for leather, as well as for cloth. And on top of that, a lot of different ways to process the peanut into different kinds of peanut flours, peanut oil. And although, like we talked about, he popularized peanut butter, he didn't invent it. That goes way back to the Aztecs, who were cultivating peanuts and ground them into a paste.
All right. So we set that story, that myth, to rest here. I'll let Dana Chandler, you're the archivist. You've got Carver's original notebooks at Tuskegee. What sort of experiments do you see documented in his notes?
They range from testing milk and milk dyes to inventing different types of paints to his work. There was a period of time where we had dysentery on campus, and he actually traced down where the dysentery originated and was able to deal with it and resolve that issue for the campus. So the notebooks are full of his experiments dealing with crop rotation, as she just spoke about. How crops should be rotated and why, how to use a variety of legumes to help to provide nutrients to the soils that could also be nutritious for humans and animals. So the notebooks are full of wonderful information that certainly exemplifies his position as a scientist, a world-class scientist.
Are any of them open to the public? Can you go see on exhibit some of the notebooks?
Actually, we have one that's on display that people can see. But the rest of them are in the back because they are in such precarious shape. They are delicate, and I need to watch over them carefully.
Yeah, I'll bet. Kathy,
another thing that Carver was very influential in, it was extension education, bringing his research to the farmer, and doing that in bulletins that he wrote and he distributed for free, and also in a mobile classroom that was called the Jessup Wagon after the person who provided the funding to build this portable classroom that he could bring around and do demonstrations for farmers.
How was he able to do all of this? He was born into slavery during the Civil War, correct? How did he end up, you know, doing all these things?
Actually, he was born afterwards.
Afterwards?
Yes. Well, born during the Civil War, but he didn't experience the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. So, if he was born into slavery, how did he go out and become a scientist and do all these great things? What was his pathway?
Well, his mother was sold into slavery, and there's some debate whether one of his siblings was also. And he was sick early on and worked in the house. And what time he wasn't working, he was spending his time out in the fields and the forests looking at the plants and rocks and soils. And he became very interested. He accredits his curiosity that about dealing with God's creation and wanting to understand it better.
Mm. Kathy?
Well, he also ended up in Iowa.
Right.
At Simpson College, where he was originally studying art and music, which he was really talented in. And just by happenstance, one of his teachers recognized that he also had a real strong scientific bent. And her father was on the faculty at Iowa State, at that time college, now Iowa State University. And she encouraged him to go meet the faculty at Iowa State. And he ended up being the first African-American graduate from Iowa State in 1894. And the faculty were so impressed with his scientific talents, they encouraged him to stay on and get a master's degree, which he did in horticulture and plant pathology, studying diseases of plants.
Hmm. You say that Carver was the first quote-unquote green or eco-minded scientist. Dana, why is that?
Carver was really interesting in how he tried to come up with ways that farmers could utilize what they had available to them, because they couldn't go out and buy the things that they needed, such as ammonia, nitrates, and fertilizers, etc. What they had to do was use what they had, and Carver was really astute in coming up with methods on how to use things and reuse things. A couple of things that we found was we found a paint formula that he had come up with. It appears in 1943 when the United States government sent out for quotes on preparing paint to paint all the vehicles during World War II, that Carver sought to respond to that in a way that would set up a new industry. And one of the things he was going to use for the base for his paint was used motor oil.
Hmm.
I find that to be very interesting. He came up with a method how to create a stain from walnut husks, which that stain that he created is actually seen today in a building here in Tuskegee, but also in Henry Ford's summer home in Georgia.
Wow.
So
wow.
He's very good about taking things and making something out of it that you may not expect.
Recycling. Let's go to the phones. Carolyn, Manhattan, New York. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, thank you, Ira. I was so curious. Peanut, I have heard, is a legume, but because it's called a nut, it does get confusing in the health field, because if you're trying to eat nuts only, I'm constantly having to tell people that peanut is not a nut. So why did that happen, that it's called a nut, but it is not a nut?
Sometimes you feel like. Kathy?
Quite frankly, I don't know why the peanut name came into being. It is, as the caller says, not a tree nut. So that's a good question.
Dana, have any insight on that?
Not a bit. I just know that you can trace its root back to, that's a pun, isn't it? All the way back to the Inca and the pre-Incan peoples that utilized it in South America. But I don't know. I haven't got an answer for that. That's an interesting question.
All right, you've given us homework, Carol, for this evening to go out and find that out. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling. Good question. What other kinds of things did he leave us with today, Kathy? Any nutritional advice that Carver developed that we might do well to remember today?
Well, he also advocated that farmers in Alabama grow sweet potatoes. And that's a crop that in the developing world today we're trying to encourage farmers to grow, because it's high in provitamin A, which is so important for eyesight and for maintaining the immune response in growing children. So that's one of his legacies today. Another one is that you might think of him as being the father of the bioeconomy. We've got a lot of emphasis today on finding ways to develop biofuels, other bioproducts from either crops that are not competing with food or that can be grown or that are the agricultural waste can be made from agricultural waste. So this big emphasis that he had on new uses for peanuts as well as soybeans and pecans, and we heard the walnut example, is kind of the stuff that we're trying to do in finding alternatives to petroleum in agricultural products and agricultural wastes.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Last comment, Dana, he was actually, Carver was actually inducted into the Royal Society in England.
Yeah, in 1916, way before he comes on the scene and becomes very popular. He's selected as a fellow of the Royal Society of the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturers, and Commerce in London, England. One of the things I find interesting, the Society's core members are known as the Fellows, and they're only eligible to receive it because they're elected and must have demonstrated achievement or potential related to the arts, manufacturers, and commerce. This sets him apart from a lot of other people. And you think about this, at a time when we have segregation, we have Jim Crow laws, here's Carver, a black man that is elevated to a position of a famous position in England, and yet one that he doesn't receive until much later. And I guess I find out now today that people spend a lot of time wanting to know more about Carver, and yet they think they know a lot, but they don't.
Yeah.
He's a very enigmatic man, and I think, as you said in your prelim, a Renaissance man.
Yeah. Well, we're going to leave it at that, and it's a good time to talk about him on his 150th birthday. Thank you, Kathy Witecki, Chief Scientist, Undersecretary for Research, Education, Economics, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Dana Chandler, Archivist at the Tuskegee University in Alabama. Thanks again for joining
Thank
us today.
You.
Thank you, Ira.
Charles Berkowitz is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer, Cy Arts, Anna Minoff, Lou Groskin, our video producer, production assistant, Becky Fogel, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, our engineer, spinning the dials here at the studios of our production partners at the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.